This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We have two big picture time pressures that really mean we should be acting a lot more urgently than most of us have. And one of them is peak oil or energy collapse, and one of them is climate change or runaway global warming.
I think that most people, even most scientists, continue to underestimate how far down the path to climate catastrophe we've already traveled.
For the most part, we're oblivious to it. We don't want to know about it. We don't want to hear about it.
The one thing I'm most afraid of is that we're going to mount a tremendous campaign to sustain the unsustainable.
At this point, the scientists are saying that the Earth's temperature may increase by as much as 10 degrees. At that point, there may not even be bacteria left.
When the oil starts to really run dry, and when those in power have to assert their power in a time of dwindling resources, I think they're going to turn to much more blunt and cruel methods of enforcing their power.
The whole climate is changing. The winds, the ocean currents, the storm patterns, snowpack, snowmelt, flooding, droughts.
It's stunning how fast the destruction is proceeding.
Every day that passes, the world is in worse shape.
The sad-looking man you see on the screen is Derek Jensen. Jensen is the best-selling author of several non-fiction books, including A Language Older Than Words and A Culture of Make-Believe. His books deal with topics such as surveillance, child abuse, the environment, and something he calls civilization.
The friendly voice you just heard is Franklin Lopez. He created a video argument for ending civilization. Kick it over before we kill again. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with an in-depth look at the works of Deep Green writer Derek Jensen, an interview with filmmaker Lopez, and a series of ugly questions for Impossible Times. You just heard a clip from the new movie End Civ by Franklin Lopez. He was raised in the Puerto Rican independence movement. In New York, Lopez was a cameraman producer for the Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez alternative news program, Democracy Now! As The Stimulator, Frank gets millions of views for his regular video podcast, It's the End of the World as We Know It, and I Feel Fine.
This episode of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine was made possible by contributions from slaves like you. Spanky very much.
1929. It'll get worse now because it'll go faster. Money markets will dry up round the world by the end of the week. ATMs will stop spitting bills.
Patriotic slam by bright light feeling pretty sight.
Yeah, that's REM, the Canadian group. It's the end of the world as we know it, and we feel fine. Lopez went to the latest Republican and Democratic conventions, plus the Cancun Climate Summit, to film the street action, to get the outside story in. He brings us activism and voices that never make the mainstream news. There is a lot of irreverent, foul-mouthed fun in some of Lopez's productions, but in today's program, you'll hear a very serious side. For the past many years, Lopez filmed his own video interviews with hundreds of authors and activists, many you might know, like James Howard Kunstler, but Lopez takes care to find alternative voices from the streets and the woods, women, youth, Aboriginal people, the homeless, the excluded. NCIV is a master collection of them all. Zoe Blunt from the Forest Action Network, the late First Nations leader Kwatsinas, farmer from Earth First, critic John Zerzan, Paul Watson from Sea Shepherd, Dr. Michael Baker, Stephanie Mills, grid crasher Arctic McBay, and a long list of fast-moving video shorts from the underground. But the star of the show, the inspiration, is California author and philosopher Derek Jensen. Before we go to our interview with Franklin Lopez, let's get an introduction to Derek Jensen. You know my feelings about Derek Jensen are mixed. I could say I violently disagree with some of Derek's proposals, but then when Jensen uses the word violence, he really means it. He thinks Greens, anyone who cares about the Earth, should fight to stop the destruction of nature. We are beyond the time of talk, he says. Most famously, Jensen wants someone to blow up dams in the Pacific Northwest to save the beloved salmon. Picturing relatively green hydroelectric dams, I thought Jensen off base, if not dangerously mad. But digging deeper, Derek provides startling facts about thousands of useless dams built and abandoned by early loggers and settlers and corporations that continue to block many rivers. Governments have no workable plans to remove them, to restore the natural and valuable salmon fishery and the freedom of the rivers. The film NCIV goes further. Do we revere Gandhi because ruling oligarchs channel us into such peaceful protests? Were there other fighting figures behind India's independence struggle? Why don't we hear about them? Is Martin Luther King accepted while the Black Panthers are smeared because it suits authoritarian interests? What about Greenpeace? Have we been managed? What will we say to our children and grandchildren if we let Earth go down without a fight? I have my opinions on all this. You need to decide for yourself. As just one example of Derek Jensen's continuing influence, here is a quick clip from another director and filmmaker, John Cooksey, as an example of the impact Derek Jensen can have. I recorded this at a recent dinner party.
You know, there's an article that's really been sticking with me, and it was just an article. It was just an article about an interview with a guy named Derek Jensen, who you probably know, and I sort of knew his name. And what was interesting in that article was, you know, fairly reasonable guy, wasn't acting like a big gloomer doomer crazy person in the interview. Very reasonable, talking about statistics that you and I would both recognize about oil and whatever. And, you know, his basic point was that if there's going to be a habitat for the survivors, then we should monkey wrench the system right now. As much as we can, we should bring down civilization so that we don't overshoot the carrying capacity of the planet so much there's no habitat left for the survivors, whoever they may be.
He's right.
And he said that in full knowledge of the fact that if you monkey wrench the system, billions of people will starve to death in a short period of time. Like, that was obvious. That's taken as a given, right? And no guarantee that you and I and our children won't be part of that mass die from starvation, right? And that logic has haunted me. I can't pick a hole in the logic. Now, I know there's other criticisms of Derek Jensen or whatever, but the point is that he started from where we are, and he made a human emotional argument. It got me. And I'm the person who's constantly looking for the optimistic thing to root for, right, and to present as a path. And it troubled me, because it's like, wow, you know, is that the most realistic thing that I can root for? Why should I tell everybody just to go out and monkey wrench the system? Is that really the most realistic option that we have? Is to provide for the survivors, whoever they may be.
That was John Cooksey, a professional television producer, co-creator of the CBC series The Collectors, writer for diverse programs from the Disney Channel to Comedy Central. Now he has a one-man film about the journey to climate catastrophe called How to Boil a Frog. I recorded John at an evening of artists and activists in Vancouver. Hear more about that in next week's Radio EcoShock show. You can also find my short feature on Derek Jensen, produced in 2006. I said at that time, do we have to stamp out civilization to save the planet? The American author and activist Derek Jensen thinks so, and he offers his body to defeat the organized beast that is stripping the planet of forests, soil, and the species. There are three main reactions to the developing crisis here on Earth, whether you think of frightening climate change, raped ocean life, polluted slums, or just the economic unreality of the day. They are, let's fix it, let it fall, and finally the school of kick it over. Jensen is the prophet of slamming civilization, hoping it will fall before doing untold damage to nature. We'll hear from a recent speech, and we'll list some of the tenets of his belief, and add some books and web sources for further exploration. That was in 2006. Now it all looks worse. The U.S. Midwest is powered by toxic goo from the tar sands. The International Energy Agency admits peak oil has passed. The climate has gone mad, slamming millions. Derek Jensen is back. To introduce him for our feature film, NCIV, I'm going to run a quick summary of Derek's first eight premises, among many, in his own words, again from my 2006 podcast, Kick It Over. Get ready for a rapid-fire delivery of core beliefs which are startling, repulsive, and at times, just too true.
Okay, so the first premise of this book is that civilization is not and can never be sustainable. The second premise of the book is that traditional communities do not often voluntarily give up or sell the resources on which their communities are based until their communities have been destroyed. They also do not willingly allow their land bases to be damaged so that other resources, gold, oil, and so on, can be extracted. It follows that those who want the resources will do what they can to destroy traditional communities.
Those white men who've got the key to black man's identity in those lands, they're supposed to be forever.
The third premise. Our way of living is based on, requires, and will collapse very quickly without persistent and widespread violence.
What are we fighting for?
Okay, fourth premise of the book, and this is one of my favorite ones. This culture is based on a clearly defined and widely accepted, yet often unarticulated hierarchy. Violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is nearly always transparent, that is, unnoticed. When it is noticed, it's fully rationalized. Violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is unthinkable. And when it does occur, is met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims.
Social conditions, no one will openly visit the atrocious revisions of our forefathers' decisions that cast a shadow like a desert oak.
Okay, fifth premise of the book. The property of those higher on the hierarchy is more valuable than the lives of those below. It is acceptable for those above to increase the amount of property they control, in everyday language, to make money, by destroying or taking the lives of those below. This is called production. If those below damage the property of those above may kill or otherwise destroy the lives of those below. This is called justice. Okay, sixth premise of the book. This culture is not redeemable. The culture will not undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living if we don't put a halt to it. Civilization will continue to immiserate the vast majority of humans and to degrade the planet until it, civilization, and probably the planet, collapses. The effects of this degradation will continue to harm humans and non-humans for a very long time. Seventh premise. The longer we wait for civilization to crash, or the longer we wait before we ourselves bring it down, the messier will be the crash. And the worst things will be for those humans and non-humans who live during it and for those who come after.
Yeah. Now the rulers, they measure the indifference. Can you live with this history blistering like the PD opal images?
The eighth premise of the book. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. I've just made it impossible for me to hold any public office. Another way to put the eighth premise is, any economic or social system that doesn't benefit the natural communities on which it is based is unsustainable, immoral, and really stupid. Sustainability, morality, and intelligence, as well as justice, requires the dismantling of any such economic or social system, or at the very least disallowing it from damaging your land base.
Listen close up to the hum of the land. Wheat belts kind of thirsty for some sustenance and the indelible scars from years of pastoralist hands.
For the rest of Derek Jensen's premises in rapid-fire order, just download the free MP3, Kick It Over, from ecoshock.org. Find the link in this week's show blog at ecoshock.info. By the way, those music clips in between are from a benefit to stop a Canadian mining project in Australia and the destruction of the ancient Lake Cowell, and it was performed by Combat Wombat.
Radio EcoShock.
Here's one more clip from the introduction of the new film, NCIV.
But it's statements like these that make him so controversial.
They're thinking of raising the Shasta Dam in California, and the reason that Senator Feinstein gave, was it is Californians' God-given right to water their lawns. You know, there is no way to argue with that, except with explosives.
That was Mr. Jensen in 2006, the same year he published a two-volume set called Endgame. In Endgame, he argues that there is an urgent need to bring down civilization.
If people would have brought down civilization 100 years ago, people in the Pacific Northwest could still eat salmon. There's going to be people sitting along the Columbia 50 years from now, and they'll be glowing, for one thing, but they'll be starving to death, and they'll be saying, I'm starving to death because you didn't take out the dams that killed salmon. And those dams were used for barging and for electricity, for aluminum smelters, for beer cans. So, God damn you.
He lays out his case against civilization by enumerating 20 premises. Due to time limitations and the fact that most people would not tolerate a 20-hour movie, we will explore four of these premises and accompany them with real-life examples.
Industrial civilization, civilization itself, but especially industrial civilization, is not and can never be sustainable. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of life that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. Civilization is a way of life characterized by the growth of cities.
So you've got groups of people living in a dense enough population that the local land base cannot support them. What that means is you have to get your basic resources from somewhere else because you've used them up where you live. So you're going to go out into the countryside and gather up whatever it is you want, bring it back in.
I think we are ready. Let's talk with filmmaker Franklin Lopez about his multimedia ode to a work by Derek Jensen called Endgame. This is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, and I'm glad to have a guest here in the studio. I've got Franklin Lopez. He was born in San Juan, Puerto Rico, but now he's based out of Vancouver, Canada. He's been doing what he calls culture jamming with various media. He's got, he worked with Democracy Now. What were you doing with Democracy Now, Frank?
I was a video producer, so it was basically all the visual elements of the show fell on the shoulders of the video producers. So I would cut video, shoot video, create graphics for the show, and also like help out with the show ideas and whatnot.
Well, this explains how you can come up with that podcast. It's like 10 or 12 minutes long usually, and it's called, what's it called?
It's called It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine.
Right, and it's crammed with clips, and also you have original interviews that you've done with people that we'd never hear about in the mainstream media. You find them, and there they are. So you're obviously a cameraman, a producer, a video editor, and a troublemaker.
Oh, indeed.
A troublemaker. So, well, let's talk a little bit about your background. Why did you end up, do you think, becoming an activist, and how have you grown into that role?
Well, first and foremost, I need to honor my dad because my dad has been doing activism and political work in Puerto Rico to the benefit of the Puerto Rican people since he was 19. So he certainly helped me politicize myself. Although we don't agree on everything, he did show me the importance of giving a damn and actually doing things about it. And I can only hope to do as much as he did because he certainly was a pretty high achiever. But secondly, I think that political music was one of the ways in which I was able to sort of like bypass mental barriers of accepting certain ideas and looking at the world from a different perspective. And I credit Public Enemy for being a big gateway into the world of, in a way, alternative media, because in a way they were like they were almost like a radio station.
And it seems to me, following your career as I have to some degree, at least for the last few years, that you find the real action is important is what's happening behind the TV cameras. It's what's happening on the streets between people rather than the official functions the cameras are supposed to be looking at, all the guys in suits that arrive in limousines and hold conferences. Am I right there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when you look at social change, social change is achieved on the streets. It's not achieved behind closed doors. Usually the people behind closed doors are buckling to some sort of a pressure that's being put by a mass of people who are doing stuff on the street. Well, you know, whether it be sittings, blockades, or, you know, even like confrontations with the police. People show their power in numbers, and those things take place in the cities and in the streets of the world. And I think that the mainstream media is not very interested in covering those things. But as these things get larger, as we're seeing like right now in Europe, for instance, it's very hard to ignore.
You went and covered the Republican convention back in the recent presidential elections and all of that. And you came away with film when other people were getting it taken away by the police. Would you care to share with us how you did that?
Yeah. I first also have to clarify, too, that I went to the Democratic convention, too, because I really wanted to show that it was important to oppose both parties, because both parties are culpable with the problems of America and the world and the United States as well. But in St. Paul for the Republican convention, we just developed a method of collecting video and putting it out there. And we basically had a secret location where video people like myself were basically doing a tape intake. So we had shooters out on the streets, we had runners, and then we had our location. So tapes would be run to us from our camera people on the street, and then it would land in my lap, and I would have to make something out of it. So even like the first day of the anti-Republican mobilizations, both my cameramen were arrested. We were able to get their tapes out before they actually went to jail.
You did a tour of the United States called Hopium. Tell us about that.
Yeah, mostly on the West Coast of the United States, but I also included Colorado in that. That was a multi-purpose tour. The main idea behind Hopium, you know, as I think it was Mao who said, religion is the opium of the people. I think hope, as Obama put it, is the opium of the people now. Obama sold this idea, pretty big words, hope and change, where people like myself who have been following the electoral process for some time know that that's, you know, those are basically empty promises. And my goal was to show people that Obama is an advertising dream. He's been manufactured by PR people and politicians as an Uber candidate who really serves the goals of the elites, of the power structure, of the bankers, of the big corporations, of the military-industrial complex. Every 4 years in the United States, people who fall within the center or a little bit left of the center sort of abandon their politics for that 1 year to basically throw all their energy and support towards a Democratic candidate, when we see the track record of both Republicans and Democrats is not much different. So what I was trying to do is basically burst everybody's bubble, which is basically one of the things that I like to do the most. While being on the road, having the tour fund the travel, I did the majority of the interviews I did for my film, NCIV.
Okay, well, let's get to that film, NCIV, and that stands for End Civilization?
End the Civilization, that's correct.
Talk to us about the basic premise of the film.
The basic premise is it just takes the ideas put forth by Derek Jensen in two books that he wrote called Endgame. He released these in 2006. One of the interesting things that he does in the books is instead of trying to lure the reader into these ideas, he comes up front and puts out the premises of the book. So the, you know from the get-go exactly what he's going to propose, what he's going to try to explain. And the very first premise is civilization is not and can never be sustainable. And this is particularly of industrial civilization. And so what I try to do in the film is take a few of the premises of his books and bring them to life. So, for example, there's a premise on this culture being an industrial civilization, being based on violence. I take that premise and I juxtapose our sort of Western way of life with gadgets, with diamonds, with instant on electricity, and I show where those items or that energy or whatnot comes from. So I have a light switch, and on the other side I have an explosion going off at an open pit mine of coal, right, for instance, just to show that for us to have this awesome electricity that we are so attached to, mountains have to be destroyed.
The concept of civilization being the problem, it's not a new one in deep green thought. And I just interviewed a fellow named Dr. Tim Garrett, who's worked out an actual formula in physics showing that the more wealth you have, the worse the environment's going to be and the worse the climate's going to be. And that's how it is. So you either shrink your wealth or you lose the environment. Is that still on track with what your film and what Derek Jensen is saying?
Yeah, I think it's another way of arriving at the same conclusion. I didn't really do this in the film, and when you look at critiques of civilization, everything goes back to domestication, specifically domestication of wheat, i.e., agriculture. And I think that's at that point where things started going awry. That's when you started to have population growth, but also that's when you started having slavery. That's when you started having a division of labor. That's when you started having hierarchies of work. And I think a lot of our problems, you know, when people look at my film, especially anti-capitalists or anarchists or communists or socialists or whatnot, they point out that I don't use the word capitalism a whole lot in my film. And they say, well, capitalism is the problem. And I say, yeah, well, capitalism is a problem, but capitalism is born out of civilization. So when we are looking at problems and we want to get rid of ourselves of problems, we have to look at the root. Otherwise, everything is just Band-Aids, right? So civilization is at the core of the problems that we're facing today. And we need to basically go deep into why things devolve in such a bad way. So it's a long history there, and I obviously don't have the time to put all out there. But just as I explained, agriculture was essentially the domestication of the land. And from there on, we just kept domesticating and also appropriating things that as men or as a human that are ours, that we, as one of the people in my film, we made ourselves masters of creation. And that gave us ownership and gave us permission to destroy, plunder, and loot.
There are still a few Aboriginal people living off the earth sustainably, and some people think that they can give us some leadership. Do you talk about Aboriginal people in your film?
Yeah, they're very prominent in my film. As an anarchist, I am often asked to imagine or to exemplify how anarchism will work, you know, being a system without huge hierarchies, without the big centralized power that we see in the world right now. And the world I envision is a world without hierarchies and a world in which people live sustainably and respect the land and respect each other, respect gender, respect people with different lifestyles. And Aboriginal people, and the examples I use are the ones from North America, live sustainably in North America for over 10,000 years. And to a large degree, many of them have very egalitarian societies, very little conflict, not a whole lot of war. A lot of them never really experienced famish, never really knew what something like going hungry was like. When people want to look at things that have worked, especially here in North America, we don't have to go that far. You know, these folks have tremendous oral traditions, and you can see how quickly civilization, once it arrived here, has destroyed the land. So I think it's not just important, it's imperative that we look at how indigenous peoples have lived and how they have, quote unquote, managed, even though I don't like to use that word, nature, and try to see if we can figure out a way to apply those things to our current situation. I understand that everything's been scaled up just because of, again, population growth, and that we might not be ready to just give up on agriculture, but there's got to be a different way. And indigenous people would certainly be amazingly helpful in showing us the way to a more sustainable future.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Franklin Lopez. He's the producer of a new film called End CIV, and you can find that at ncIV.com. Franklin, or Frank, I can practically feel some of my listeners shivering and saying, we're not going back to that. We're not giving up all this. I mean, I really like to have my deluxe coffee. I like to drive my car around. I like the civilization the way it is. And yet, I've had scientists on this program saying, we're going to crash anyway. And we've had peak oil experts on this program saying, this can't go on for much longer. We just don't have enough oil. If everybody lives the way we live, we need another four Earths to do it. So what do we do about this idea of collapse? And I think Derek Jensen is suggesting the sooner we kick it over, the better.
Last week, I screened the film at the COP16. And granted, I was showing the film to a group of people who were already almost there with me with the ideas of the film. One of the people just said, you know, and kind of brought up the critique of pacifism that I have in the film, and said, if we just stop participating, the system will collapse. You know, we don't have to use militant action to actually stop the destruction. And I told her that that was a very selfish position, that there are already people who are feeling the effects of the violence of civilization, you know, not to mention just how the ecological destruction is just affecting many, many people, especially in the global south. Now, we and the first world have been reaping the benefits of this violence, and you don't have to go very far south to see how our violence has been affecting people. We have the responsibility, and we have to honor all these people that we essentially, whether we knew it or not, were screwing over. And just to take a position that we just have to let it collapse, I think that shows very little foresight, in the sense that nobody really knows the future. I think that as things start to collapse, I don't think it's going to be instant. I don't think it's going to be fast. And I think as the empire, you know, being just, you know, the Western world, not just the United States, but also Canada, is going to, in acts of desperation, try to eat up more resources to keep itself alive. And I think that if we allow that to happen, the actual destruction is going to accelerate. It's not going to slow down. You know, one example of this, which I use in my film, is the Alberta tar sands. I mean, that thing is just the most insane thing in the world. You are synthetically generating oil by clearing this beautiful, massive area in a very faraway land, destroying the lifestyle of people who have been, again, living sustainably in that land for many thousands of years, so that you can run your car. And I just think this is one example. You know, you can look at hydrofracking. You can look at how deep they're trying to build wells underwater. We've already seen a huge example of this, even though all this stuff happens all the time. And, you know, one of the things that doesn't get really talked about is, like, let's just look at Nigeria and how we're destroying that country so that we can drive cars. I think that we need to look outside of our first world existence and our comfort and our desire for solar panels, which, by the way, still require raw material that needs to be mined. You know, I think people never really take those things into the equation. We need to look beyond how cushy our lifestyle is and look at how we've been destroying the world and how we've created poverty and violence around the world.
And in the film, you, along with Paul Watson and others, are pretty critical of mainstream environmental groups, including Greenpeace or people like Friends of Earth. Why? What's the problem there?
As we talked in the earlier interview, I just don't think that these groups have a full analysis on what's causing the destruction of the planet. They, to a large degree, side with the capitalists in their so-called solutions to our issues. I think the most egregious example, and is the one that I use in my film, which I wish I was making this stuff up, is the Canadian Boreal Forest Agreement, in which Greenpeace and David Suzuki and I think it was seven environmental groups and Canadian forest industry, I forget the exact name of it's basically the logging industry of Canada, made a deal in which, you know, supposedly a chunk of the boreal forest was going to be saved. And that's sort of questionable, but I'm not really going to get into that right now. In exchange for Greenpeace and all these other groups basically silence themselves at any criticism of boreal forest logging practices. And this agreement also requires these groups that if the Forest Products Association finds criticisms of their logging practices, that are old on their websites or whatever, they are required to actually delete these things from the website. So it's almost like retroactive, right? All for what? So that the Forest Products Association can, quote unquote, produce more sustainable or more friendly products. Again, you have the big greens facilitating capitalism there. They're facilitating this whole idea of green products, of greenwashing, where we should be really thinking about moving away from that. You know, one of the things that Derek Jensen talks about a lot, which I don't really touch upon in the film a whole lot, is this idea that personal consumer choices are going to be the way of saving the planet. When you actually look at, for instance, how much the military consumes oil, or how much industry goes through water. You know, we as consumers are a tiny fraction of the larger problem. The institutions that are creating most of the destruction are outside of our out of our voting for our dollars, so to speak. And those are the institutions that need to be stopped. And this is not really talked about by Greenpeace. The Greenpeace is not really talking about the military, you know, and that needs to be talked about, you know. I just think that sometimes organizations become too big for their own good, and sometimes they are too attached to the money that comes in through donations, through foundations or whatnot, to actually do the things that their original mandate was. And Greenpeace is just, you know, I pick on them just because they are probably the most visible. But, you know, you just can go down the line, you know, WWF, Forest Ethics, etc.
Well, you have some sacred cows that you're kicking in this film, and one of them includes Martin Luther King, it seems to me, and another one was Gandhi. You're going after some big names there. And this is one of the points where you and I do have a disagreement. We've talked about this. Derek Jensen, when he was up here in Vancouver making a speech, he told the audience that he has his own AK-47, you know. And I found that a little bit too macho. And this is a country in Canada where very few people have guns, and I kind of like it that way. So the whole idea of using violence to achieve the ends of a cleaner climate or a better world, for me, I'm against that. But in the film, you're suggesting that I'm wrong to think that way. Tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. I personally don't have anything against pacifism as a philosophy. And this is coming from me, who used to be a pacifist. I also don't think it has to be about being macho or anything like that. In the film, I used the example of Oka, which, briefly, Mohawks had a piece of land that was sacred to them, and the city wanted to take over that land and expand the golf course. And they tried. They tried all the different ways, you know, petitioning the government directly and whatnot. I mean, this is their land. This is their traditional land. And all other means failed. And so they took out guns, and they saved their land. And the one quote that a Mohawk woman, told the media there is, "We treat these trees and the land like our mother. These people are raping our mother. What would you do if they rape your mother?" And I think that metaphor really brings it home for us. I personally abhor violence. I abhor the violence that's being done to the planet. I abhor the violence that's being done to people all over the world. But that violence is not stopping. It's not stopping with the tools that we're using. And, you know, one of the points that I'm trying to make in the film is that all these tools have been given to us by the power structure. So the power structure is not going to give us tools that are going to be successful against them. They're going to give us tools that are going to be ineffective, but they're going to give the illusion that we live in a democratic society and that these tools are bound to work. When people tell me that they're against violence, I usually ask, "Do you have a son? Do you have a daughter?" "Yes." "Okay. What if you saw somebody assaulting your son or daughter?" The answer is almost certainly always, 99.9% of the time, I would beat the crap out of the person that's doing that to my daughter, to defend my daughter. And I said, "Well, you see, you just use violence." So I think that we're very comfortable in our analysis that we're pacifists and that we're nonviolent. But when it comes to the people and the things that we love, we will gladly use it. I'm applying this to the planet. And we don't have another planet. And the planet is being killed, it's being raped, it's being tortured, it's being murdered. Our tactics are not working. We don't have unlimited time. So I'm not saying that violence is the only way, but what I'm trying to do in the film is to have this conversation that we never have, because it's taboo. Nobody wants to talk about it. It's been so beaten down our heads that to even think about violence is bad, that we don't even talk about it. Yet, at least in the United States, when you look at the heroes of the revolution, the people who kicked out the king of England, they had a resistance movement that was amazingly diverse, that used violence, but that wasn't their only tool. They used boycotts. They used all sorts of direct action that were, you know, property destruction, i.e. like inanimate objects. We have to look at all these things. We cannot discount one thing or one tool just because we need all hands on deck. And if somebody sabotages a, for instance, coal-fired power plant or stops open pit mining in the Appalachian Mountains to stop blowing off the top of a mountain for coal, I certainly support that because I think that what's at stake is it's a lot larger than anything we've ever faced before. And these are pretty big questions, and I don't expect people to agree with me on the outset. Really, what would make my film successful is not that people be in full agreement with me, but that at least they talk about these things with themselves. And I'll finally say one more thing. Maybe the film looks at Gandhi in a very heavy-handed way, but as you say, Gandhi is that sacred cow. And I'm not saying that Gandhi was wrong. Gandhi's use of nonviolence was extremely powerful. But the main point is that the movement for the independence of India was amazingly diverse. And they won that independence by the use of all tactics. And Gandhi was just one element of that. Same thing goes to Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King was amazingly successful. But he wasn't the only element. You know, there were also more militant elements that applied pressure to the power structure and eventually caused them to buckle and to enact civil rights legislation. So history doesn't really give us most of the time the full picture. And if we really want to be honest with ourselves, we have to look at the full picture. And again, this is not a point at which I arrived very easily. It took me years of mulling it over. And as somebody who was, you know, asked me 7-8 years ago if I would be having this conversation with you, I probably would be like, no, violence bad, and I just, that's the end of the story.
It's interesting to see this side of you because in your podcast, It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine, there's a certain amount of the jokester to you. You have a lot of fun with the film clips, and sometimes you blow our minds, I think. And here in this film, it's more somber, and it's more serious. The message is pretty deep. So how are you going to get this out to people? NCIV is the name of the film. How are you going to promote it? How are people going to find out about it?
I was trying to make this as not mainstream, because I know a lot of the ideas are not ever going to be mainstream, but at least as accessible to the public as possible. But in the end, like, my target audience are activists, are people who already have done a certain bit of analysis, you know, so that when they arrive at the film, they're not coming in with, you know, with very little information. I don't want to have to explain climate change to them. I want them already going there with the idea that this is a problem, right? But I'm not going to fool myself into thinking that, especially when I have a critique of, as you say, sacred cows or pacifism or whatnot, that anybody's really going to give me a large platform to do this. So I'm going on tour with the film in a very grassroots way. I'm hitting like 60 cities in North America next year. I've already done 6 screenings in Mexico this year. And then I'll be going to Europe, and then I'll be going to Australia. And Japan, I hope. And on May 1st, between the beginning of the tour, which starts in February, to May 1st, I'm going to be doing a campaign of promoting the launch of the film as a free download on May Day. I've had some success with getting videos out to people on the internet for more than 10 years now. And I think that this film speaks to a lot of people. And I think that once it's out there online, which, you know, may be available online before I want it to be online, but I'll just have to live with that. If I can reach 100,000 people with this film, I'll feel that it's a success, although people already tell me that I'll probably reach, you know, more than that. But, you know, one of the things that I would like to say is that, it's true. I like to laugh. I think laughter is the only thing that keeps me sane in these amazingly dire and trying times. I did try to put a couple of bits of humor in the film so that your viewers don't think that they're walking into this film with no break.
Well, it's packed with video clips that you're just not going to see anywhere else and a lot of original interviews that you did. In fact, when I was looking at it, I was thinking, what a bear this was to make. I look at like in a minute and there's 35 clips in it. You must have spent an immense amount of time making this.
From conception to completion, it was about 4 years. I really spent the last two, as they say in Canada, giving her. But it's, you know, it's just like all things, you know, you start with this big piece of marble and you don't know. So you just start chipping away until you start seeing the form. But once you see accelerate, once you're seeing what you're getting, then you start, you know, start getting exciting and start chipping at it faster. So yeah, so the past 2 years I've been editing more and more and more, but also like collecting a lot of the interviews and such. And then when it came down to this summer and I had pretty much all my material, it's just that I had this amazing palette, and all I had to do, it was heavenly. All I had to do is get the people who were actually funding my film, which were small donations from people who found the website, to basically buy my time, to basically help me not go and work, you know, for a client or whatnot doing video editing. And I just spent the summer just cutting, and I probably edited half the film between May and October.
And you called it crowdfunding or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I can't claim the term, but it certainly, I was amazed that it worked. And basically the way I did it is that once I would finish a section of the film, whether it was fully edited or just, you know, in a mostly completed state, I would release the clip online. And if people liked it and they wanted to help with the next clip, then they would donate.
Right. And what's the website for?
It's endciv.com, so ncif.com. And for viewers who have friends who only speak Spanish, there's a Spanish website too, which is FINCIV, so fincive.com.
Fincive.com?
Sí.
Sí. We'll be there. Well, it's just been a super pleasure talking with you. Franklin Lopez, he's the director, producer, and be-all of this new film, NCIV. I've looked at it. I recommend it to people. It made me think a couple times. It made me mad. A couple other times, it pretty well brought me to tears to see the situation that we're in. And you get so much more of that graphically when you see these images of the tar sands and you see the images of what happened with the Aboriginal people. And I could go on for a long time, but I got a lot out of this film, so I'm recommending it. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. You've just heard a sample of frustration from the anarchist camp, and it's echoing throughout the Western society. Riots, some deadly violent, have broken out in European countries and in North Africa. Do riots really accomplish anything? Not according to Forbes magazine, the self-labeled capitalist tool. Their December 22nd article, How Riots Can Influence an Economy, carefully catalogs the economic costs of violent protest. Forbes says, quote, riots with clear economic proximate causes have fortunately become very rare in the United States, though they were much more common in the early days of industrialization and unionization and the protests that accompanied the WTO conference in Seattle in 1999 were an uncomfortable reminder. If you've been a victim, your losses may be deductible. Find out how. See Deducting Disaster, Casualty, and Theft Losses. End quote. It's all tax deductible. Well, not all. There is damage to business property and some economic activity is curtailed while rocks and police fill the streets. It's hard to do one's duty as a consumer when the stores are closed. Some tourists stay away while others come for the opportunity to riot or at least watch. And I love the slightly cynical summary Forbes magazine gives to this tactic. Quote, by and large, there is very little evidence that rioting works in the sense of leading to any lasting redress of grievances. If anything, many governments tend to respond to riots by enacting more draconian laws and beefing up the budgets of those charged with suppressing trouble. When governments do respond, it is usually just with temporary solutions designed to pacify the protesters and get them off the streets. Vague promises of redress, government-sponsored reforms, or temporary subsidies, particularly in the case of food or fuel riots, will often mollify the crowds, but seldom lead to any lasting improvement in the quality of the life of the people. End quote from Forbes. I suppose that's true enough, until the crowd overwhelmed the government, as happened in Iceland. After tossing the debt of less than 100 bankers onto the people of Iceland, the government was tossed out itself every few hundred years or so. This does happen. Then again, the poor peasants of France suffered poverty and hardship for several hundred years before rising up in their famous revolution. There is nothing to indicate North Americans will not take another 100 years to revolt.
Tension was gradually building up outside the Dhaka Stock Exchange. Investors did not want to see another day of huge losses. Tempers ran high and the record fall triggered clashes between protesters and police.
In 3 days, the rate has fallen and the small investors are losing. All the rich people are now buying shares. The rates are falling and they're buying and we can't do any business.
Bangladesh's stock market soared in recent years, attracting millions of small investors. But regulators brought in a series of measures late last year after concerns that shares were overvalued. The move forced big investors to withdraw from the market, triggering panic among individual investors. Shares have become a popular investment for ordinary people, often providing higher returns than bank deposits and savings. Many are afraid that if the downward trend of the stock market continues, then they will lose their lifetime savings. Anbaras Nithirajan, BBC News, Dhaka.
American right-wing radio is rife with rumors the American military is waiting in the wings to wade into any riots coming out of the economic crisis. 2 years after the original Pentagon study, that fear finally leaked off the internet into mainstream TV while you were Christmas shopping. It's instructive to follow the gossip, especially since the Pentagon has already announced a kind of net information warfare, which might include planting false rumors. Or are they subtly announcing a threat to jobless Americans? The sliver of information leaked out through cable news on CNBC. The date is uncertain, although the net video says November 19, 2010. Glenn Beck on Fox News quoted the same CNBC story on December 8, 2010. Conspiracist radio host Alex Jones had a field day with it, and ultra-conservative or Christian militarist net radio stations with names like, well, you know, The Warning or Morning Star or Liberty Bell, they blurted out the fearsome news. The troops who trained kicking in doors in Iraq are coming home to rule us, they say. Here is the essential clip with reporter Amon Javers of CNBC.
And in the Army, they're having a very interesting year-long exercise called Unified Quest 2011. And in that wargaming series, they're looking at the implications of large-scale economic breakdown inside the United States that would force the Army to keep, quote, domestic order among civil unrest and force the Army to deal with fragmented global power and drastically lower budgets. This according to the trade publication InsideDefense.com. And in October, military officials from the Marine Corps War Colleges visited the trading floor of J.P. Morgan to study markets and the economy. So, Tyler, you can see that all different parts of the Pentagon and Defense Intelligence Establishment are looking at markets and looking at ways they can present a new kind of threat to the United States. These are the guys whose job it is to think about the very worst possible things that could happen, and they've dreamed up some very scary scenarios here.
Back all right, Eamon, thank you very much. Eamon Javers.
If we riot, the Pentagon has apparently got the plans to put it down. They have wargamed it in a project called Unified Quest 2011. To save you hours of Googling time, here is the scoop. Spencer Ackerman wrote about Unified Quest in Wired Magazine's Danger Room back on September 15, 2010, quote, "That's where something called Unified Quest comes in. Every year, the Army's chief of staff instructs talented mid-career and senior officers and senior enlisted women or men to evaluate where the service is falling short and propose remedies. On Tuesday, about 120 soldiers and their civilian and foreign military friends, and even some Marines, swarmed onto the manicured Northern Virginia campus of mega consultant Booz Allen Hamilton to kick off the four-day debating bull session for Unified Quest 2011 to figure out how best to cultivate the next generation of Army leaders." End quote. Ackerman claims to be the only blogger allowed in, providing he did not mention any names. We wonder why he was let in. Spooks abound. And the implied date in the article is wrong. The What If War Games party in Fort Monroe, Virginia started July 15th. There are official Army documents available on the web about the time and location, but not the contents. And the project appears to have continued at least later into the summer and perhaps until the present day. CNBC quotes the trade journal InsideDefense.com as their source for the same quotes that went out everywhere. The same few words and phrases found all over the net and in Glenn Beck came from this simple abstract rather than the full article hidden away behind a rather low paywall. Actually, you could get it for free as a sample if you're willing to sign up, but then you go on to Defense Department computers, I would imagine. This shines a sad light into journalism. Months after the event, the same few phrases are released as news without even an hour of investigation. And there are earlier versions of the same tale of the Army is coming for years previously. Jim Myers wrote U.S. Military Preparing for Domestic Disturbances on December 23, 2008. His source was a paper titled Known Unknowns, Unconventional Strategic Shocks in Defense Strategy Development by former Army Lieutenant Colonel Nathan Fryer. Fryer wrote, quote, "Widespread civil violence inside the United States would force the defense establishment to reorient priorities, in extremis, to defend basic domestic order. An American government and defense establishment lulled into complacency by a long secure domestic order would be forced to rapidly divest some or most external security commitments in order to address rapidly expanding human insecurity at home." End quote. Well, maybe that's the good news. The administration finds a face-saving way to bring the troops home, citing the need for domestic security, i.e. putting down mass riots, and maybe you. Instead of the embarrassing loss of funds or belief in the U.S. dollar abroad falling away, I mean, America can't afford all those bases anyway. Going with Jim Myers' selection, quote, "The Army College report states DOD might be forced by circumstances to put its broad resources at the disposal of civil authorities to contain and reverse violent threats to domestic tranquility. Under the most extreme circumstances, this might include use of military force against hostile groups inside the United States. Further, DOD would be, by necessity, an essential enabling hub for the continuing of political authority in a multi-state or nationwide civil conflict or disturbance," end quote, from the Department of Defense document. Nathan Fryer concluded that section of the report by observing, quote, "DOD is already challenged by stabilization abroad. Imagine the challenges associated with doing so on a massive scale at home," end quote. Yes, indeed. But why rely on secondhand sources? The super secret document is available as a free PDF download from Strategic Studies Institute at army.mil, or buy the book for $9.99 from, well, I can't name the publisher. It's that big online company who buckled to the State Department their pressure in the WikiLeaks scandal. Army think tanker Nathan Fryer writes, quote, "Thus, there is perhaps no greater source of strategic shock for the Department of Defense than operationalizing that component of the oath of service in a widespread domestic emergency that entails rapid dissolution of public order in all or significant parts of the United States. While likely not an immediate prospect, this is clearly a black swan that merits some visibility inside the DOD and the Department of Homeland Security. To the extent events like this involve organized violence against local, state, and national authorities and exceed the capacity of the former two to restore public order, DOD would be required to fill the gap." Friends, that is one objection to the strategy of violence. It breeds more violence and repression. The American society and most modeled after it have specialized in force as an export product, but the troops can always come back home. With the federal government already impotent, it isn't hard to imagine a series of riots, the shopkeepers and some of the public long for public order. A magnetic figure or an unknown army officer pops up to fill this longing. After decades of support for military dictators abroad, the United States attempts to prolong the dream of empire with a decade or two of military rule. Rome did it. Why can't we? And hey, the U.S. Armed Forces appear to understand that both peak oil and climate change are realities that can't be denied. The Army, Navy, and Air Force are looking for more and more alternative energy, being far ahead of their own government. Sad to say, but some desperate Greens might welcome a wartime-style project trying to save civilization. Derek Jensen says civilization is the problem. I'll be in the hills growing potatoes if you need me. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Visit our website at ecoshock.org.